Strike with managing editor Zachary Fillingham of geopoliticalmonitor.com. And today we're going to talk about developments in the Kashmir conflict. So Zach, what's new in Kashmir?
Okay, so as most of you probably know, the Kashmir conflict has flared up recently between India and Pakistan. It all happened, well, what triggered this most recent flare-up was an event on February 14th when militants crossed the line of control and launched an attack on an Indian paramilitary unit, resulting in 46 deaths. It was the deadliest attack against Indian forces in Kashmir since 1989, and it precipitated an international conflict, which has been well covered in the news, one in which India initially launched a cross-border raid on Pakistan-controlled Kashmir and dropped bombs on what the Indian government says was a militant training camp. And days later, Pakistan responded with its own sortie into India-controlled Kashmir, which resulted in two jets being shot down, one Indian and one Pakistani, and the subsequent drama with the captured Indian pilot.
So, Zach, as the article on the website, geopoliticalmonitor.com, discusses, this is something that is just another instance in a long-running dispute between Pakistan and India. So what makes this different and what makes this important? Or is this just another incident that may not have significant geopolitical ramifications?
I think that this incident sort of stands as a reminder that the Kashmir conflict is still unresolved, and at any time it's able to trigger a resurgence in tensions between India and Pakistan, obviously two nuclear-armed states. So this is something that, in a geopolitical sense, we should all be concerned about. Lately, Kashmir has been, obviously, just a very, very quick history of the Kashmir conflict. It was in the 19th century a princely state with colonial borders. These borders grouped together Hindus, Muslims, and to a lesser degree Buddhists in Ladakh. In the partition process in 1947, which created Pakistan and India from the previous British colonial territory, there was a dispute over which of the successor states gets Kashmir. There was an armed conflict, which ended up being the first armed conflict between India and Pakistan. And as we know, there would be subsequent ones. And that conflict created the line of control. So it remains exclusively claimed by both New Delhi and Islamabad, which both claim the entirety of Kashmir. This conflict has proceeded for decades now. It flared up in the 1990s with an armed insurrection in Kashmir, which was supported by the Pakistani security establishment. That resulted in hundreds of deaths, civilian security forces on the Indian side. It came to a sort of lull/end in 2004 when there was an attempted assassination attempt on then President Pervez Musharraf by Kashmir militants, which kind of curbed the Pakistani government's enthusiasm for supporting militants in the region. And just to fast forward to more recently, the most important sort of recent historical context for the event is since 2016, there's been a near constant protest movement in India controlled Kashmir based demanding independence. And this is kind of this is a protest movement that has to do with governance in the area. It has to do with low economic opportunity, and it has to do with a pervasive military presence of the Indian authorities and the sort of heavy-handed treatment that some of the locals get at the hands of these authorities. For example, in 2016, this recent protest movement that was triggered in 2016, it was triggered by the death of a separatist militant named Burhan Muzaffar Wani, who had a really big social media presence, and he had a lot of followers, and he kind of like was a humanized face of the separatist struggle in Kashmir. And he was killed when he was killed by security forces. Sorry, he was 22 years old, so he was young as well. When he was killed by the security forces, it triggered a protest movement that went on basically to this day. And one thing to note is that Wani was radicalized. The thing that made him become a militant was supposedly being taken aside by the security forces in Kashmir and beaten in 2010 with some of his friends. And the individual who's ascribed to or who is supposedly conducted the February 14th attack that killed 47 members, 46 members of the Indian paramilitaries. He also had a similar background where a couple of years previous, him and a couple of friends were pulled aside by security forces and severely beaten. So you see this kind of cycle of radicalization taking place within India-administered Kashmir, where there is some real simmering tensions between the civilian population and the security forces.
And what, Zach, could you elaborate a bit on what the divide is? Why is it that peace and a resolution of this conflict has been unsuccessful? What are the different factions? What are the different beliefs? And why is this something that can't be resolved diplomatically?
I think I mean, like, it has become a point of pride, a sort of existential point of pride for both countries. And since both countries claim the entirety of Kashmir, there hasn't been a lot of room for compromise through the whole history of the conflict. It's become a sort of non-negotiable point of pride for both. So that's also why it is such a potentially incendiary event whenever the Kashmir conflict kicks up. When we saw this limited exchange of conventional warfare between the two states, it's truly alarming because, generally speaking, there's not a lot of wiggle room on both sides. Both governments will be pushed by their populations to take a hard line. This time, particularly with India, with the BJP in government, which is Prime Minister Modi's party, the BJP and the RSS under it, they support a hardline version of Hindu nationalism. The way that they see India is more, India is a primarily a Hindu country, and sort of at the expense of India's minorities, Muslims, India is an incredibly diverse country with a lot of minorities, a lot of different languages, a lot of different religions, right? So they want to recast Indian identity as a primarily Hindu country, sort of in accordance with the demographics of India. Obviously, Hindus are the majority within India. So that kind of plays in the foreign policy with regards to Kashmir and Pakistan relations. For example, technically, Kashmir should be afforded a higher level of autonomy as per the Indian constitution because of its relatively unique status. So it's supposed to be a somewhat autonomous region within the Indian Federation, but Prime Minister Modi has always gotten, well, he's always been a supporter of basically not affording this autonomy, not giving Kashmir a special status. And the RSS movement that backs him also shares this belief. So he's hamstrung from the beginning. He can't really address the ground level political realities that might diffuse the tension on the ground within Kashmir. Because of his own domestic politics. And similarly with Pakistan, as we know, the Pakistan governance in Pakistan is almost half civilian, half security. The civilian government always gets a considerable amount of indirect and direct pressure from the security establishment. So that bureaucracy is always trying to maximize its own interests in the context of domestic and foreign policy. Obviously, Kashmir and any potential war with India would play big into this. So Prime Minister Khan has also on his side very little wiggle room when it comes to a conflict with India. He can't be seen as weak or standing down. And I think that the way you saw this conflict play out was kind of, really the best case scenario, because Modi, as I said, he has these domestic pressures all the time, and he has them in particular right now because he's facing a re-election in the spring, in April or May. And the polls before this weren't looking good for him recapturing a majority. If you were to rewind a year ago, a majority was supposed to be a foregone conclusion for Modi, right? So this is a big he's seen his popularity slip over the last year, mostly on economics, right? So he always has these pressures. He has these electoral pressures. The biggest attack since 1989 in Kashmir happens. Obviously, it's an open secret that a lot of these militant groups seem to get support from the Pakistani establishment, the security establishment. So he essentially has to do something, right? So he does something. He launches a conventional attack. According to Pakistan, he attacked an open field. He dropped bombs on an open field, not a madrasa or a training camp or whatever the Indian government claimed. I've seen satellite images. There are satellite images out there to suggest that that is true, that the targeted quote unquote training camp has not been hit. So, I mean, by design or not, that might have been a symbolic gesture, right? Launching an attack on a field. However, obviously, Pakistan needs to respond. They do. Both sides lose a jet. But the key here is the captured pilot, right? I think it's telling that the captured pilot was released right away. I think that that was the pressure valve that allowed this particular flare-up to come and go, hopefully. I mean, it's not totally over yet, but hopefully without any lasting threat of an extended conventional or, God forbid, nuclear exchange between these two countries. The Khan government was new enough to have the political capital to do this, and it had already launched its counterattack, right? So it had already positioned itself as the guardian of Pakistani credibility, military credibility. It had shot down a MiG-21, and now it could be in the position to hand over the pilot and hope that that was that. So both sides essentially got what they wanted in a domestic political sense out of this exchange. And the threat, when we look at future conflicts in Kashmir, is a situation where it doesn't kind of work out this neatly.
And Zach, would you say that a primary motivation is domestic political posturing rather than a direct dispute or
I
concern
think
about the other country?
I think, yeah. I mean, like, for ex yeah, I th when you have something that is this nationalistically charged, it's always going to be domestic political considerations driving events. I mean, like, the actual sort of ground level reality of Kashmir has been as it is currently for, that armed insurrection and ongoing protests aside, the line of control has remained relatively fixed for 60 years. So I don't know. I don't know if either side really thinks that they can sort of change. I put it in a different way. I don't think the Modi government launched this airstrike thinking, oh, this is going to bring the entirety of Kashmir back into India control. They launched the airstrike because they needed to send a message, quote unquote, and they sent their message.
And what about the extremist groups on the Pakistan side, the border? Can you talk a little bit about those groups and their relationship to the government of Pakistan?
Yeah, there's. I mean, it's always like unstated, right? It's kind of, as I said before, it's an open secret. There's obviously the one that was ascribed this current, the February 14th attack, Lashkar-e-Taiba. There's JEM, JEM. There's lots of different groups that have over the years they sort of split into several different categories. Some are based on full independence. Some are based on basically Kashmir's annexation to Pakistan. Some use violent means, as we know. Some are more like some have eschewed violence and now are exclusively adopting peaceful resistance. Some have no links to the ISI, and some do, like LET does. So it's basically like there are lots of different. It's a very sort of diverse ecosystem of militant groups, and I think that the thing to note here is that, I mean, like there is a sort of legitimate groundswell of desire for actual independence, and actual independence obviously doesn't mean being a part of the Pakistani state, right? So not every group is being supported by the ISI. Some are actually homegrown. Some actually turn down that kind of support because it impacts their own credibility in the eyes of their peers in Kashmir, right? Like some groups do not want to be seen as being controlled by ISI.
So, is a unifying theme amongst these different groups a desire for independence?
It would seem to be mostly yes. Of course, there are some exceptions, and then there are some groups that are fighting for increased like sort of maybe the realization of the autonomy promised to Kashmir in the Indian Federation, for example. But on the other hand, I think it's also important to say that the ISI, which is obviously the Inter-Services Intelligence, Pakistan's intelligence services, they're not necessarily controlling everything. I mean, like sometimes there's a bit of a tendency to ascribe them way more power and way more influence that they actually do have. So the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
Interesting. So what is likely to happen moving forward given this recent event?
I mean, like, I think that, like I said before, it's a conflict where there's always going to be a risk of flaring up again. And as we saw, I mean, like, this happened very quickly, right? Maybe a week after the attack, we were seeing jets being shot down. So you never really get a lot of warning. What we can say is that the political situation in Kashmir, on the Indian side, remains sort of fraught, and it remains very unstable. The protest movement is still happening. There's still incredibly frayed relations between the security forces and aspects of the civilian population, and the provincial political apparatus is like it doesn't even it's been sort of dismissed. Right now, Kashmir is being ruled from the center, under basically emergency rule by the federal government, which will go on for 6 months, and then there'll be new elections. But not to get into details about it, but the recent history of Kashmiri provincial politics have been, ineffectual, basically a series of ineffectual, stalled coalitions that have not met the needs of the domestic population. So basically, you have the preconditions for this to continue being a problem.
And other than the potential threat of nuclear war, which is always of concern, what, if any, effects will this and ongoing disputes have on the region and the world more broadly?
Oh, I mean, like I think there's always a possibility of these sorts of things spiraling out of control in such a way that would bring in other foreign actors. I mean, I don't the exact quote eludes me right now, but basically in the direct aftermath, Prime Minister Khan said something along the lines of basically. In sort of sudden crisis type situations like this, there's always a threat of a miscalculation on one side or the other, spurning into a sort of wider, potentially even world conflict, where that was never the original intention, right? It's just a cascade of miscalculations and escalations. So, I mean, like, when you even look at this, there are implications, obviously, Pakistan's close relationship with China, India's sort of baby steps or preliminary steps towards balancing against China, its own concerns about China's presence in the Indian Ocean, the quote-unquote string of pearls, the United States' growing closeness to India. There are all these factors. They all play into the Kashmir conflict. And for example, I mean, supposedly the Pakistani jet that shot down the Indian MiG-21 was an F-16, right? Obviously an American jet. So basically when Pakistan purchased these jets, I think it was 2008, they were purchased under the pretense, or this most recent upgrade, right, of the F-16s. I think Pakistan Air Force had F-16s for a while, but this most recent upgrade happened in 2008 under the auspices of the War on Terror, and the jets were basically sold to Pakistan under the promise by the Pakistani authorities that they would not be used to bolster Pakistan's conventional capacity vis-a-vis India. They were supposed to be used in the War on Terror, right? And so when I was digging around researching this, I found some of the old subcommittee, the congressional subcommittee testimonies. And one in 2008 happened under the title, Defeating Al-Qaeda's Air Force, Pakistan F-16 Program in the Fight Against Terrorism. Like, what? I never knew personally that Al-Qaeda had an air force or a conventional air force, but I mean, I guess that's just something I overlooked. But yeah, so I mean, even in that, they were not supposed to be using those F-16s in a conventional war with India. It appears as though they did. And the Pakistani military, a Pakistani military spokesman on this issue told reporters, like basically their justification or their explanation was Pakistani jets locked onto Indian targets to demonstrate Pakistan's capacity to strike back at India. So that's what produced the narrative that they used the F-16s, right? Because they got the lock. But then they chose to fire into an empty field where there would be no casualties. So according to Pakistan,
has there been any U.S. response to the use of the U.S. Provided plane?
As yet, none. I don't think we're going to get one because it's a little bit embarrassing. You know, it's definitely, I mean, just when you think about the defeating Al-Qaeda's Air Force, I mean, I don't know if like, you know, it's great to sell F-16s to a country, you know, for reasons we've covered in previous podcasts to do with the sort of military industrial complex. But like when something like this happens, you look back on it, it becomes an embarrassment, right? Because obviously the benefits in a war on terror capacity of a fifth generation dogfighting jet are, I mean, hazy to say the least.
Interesting. Yeah. And Zach, are there any other points that you want to raise before we wrap up?
I think that's it. I mean, like, I think that the way that the whole ordeal unfolded, it stands as a sort of a cautionary tale of just how quickly these things can happen. And in a way, I think we're lucky that it played out the way it did, and that we had a figure in Pakistan who was sort of politically stable in his own position to extend an olive branch. I mean, like, there's the fact that they even captured that pilot to begin with. I mean, like, what if that pilot had died on ejection and came down on the Pakistani side? There's a million different permutations that could have gone a different way, and I think we're lucky that it went this way.
Interesting. Well, thanks so much, Zach. And to our listeners, you can read the article to learn more about this topic on our website at geopoliticalmonitor.com. And looking forward to our next podcast, we'll be discussing other international and geopolitical issues. So thanks again, and talk to you next time. Thank you.